Welcome back to Video Store Nightmares, the podcast where we talk about strange, horrific, and apparently derivative films from the VHS era. My name is Luke, and I'm joined by Leland.
Hi there.
Tonight, we are going to be discussing the 1990 Italian slasher, giallo, ripoff. I don't know, how would you categorize this?
I wouldn't call this a ripoff. I think it's its own brand of awful.
Leland and I are not going to agree on this movie, I can tell. But we are talking about Night Killer, directed by Claudio Fragrasso, who you may know from movies like Troll 2.
And what else?
Let's see. He did Rats, A Night of Terror. He did... I'm just pulling up his filmography.
I mean, the point I'm getting at is I think most people just know him for Troll 2.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that, let's see, Monster Dog, I think most people have seen. That one's starring Alice Cooper. He did Rats, Night of Terror. He did After Death, which became one of the movies in the zombie series. But he also did Zombie 3 after Lucio Fulci was unable to continue. Fans of Italian cinema, I think, know this guy. His movies are their own unique brand of nonsense.
Nonsense is a great word for it.
But actually, so this is worth pointing out right at the beginning. After he had come... All right, take this with a grain of salt. So... Claudio said that this movie was his attempt to direct a serious psychological drama. And the studio was not happy with that. They wanted a slasher movie. So they hired Bruno Mattei, who actually co-wrote and co-directed some movies with Claudio. And he came in and filmed gore scenes that were added after the fact. So I'm curious to hear what scenes you think he did. But my theory is that he did the whole pre-credit sequence in the theater and that he did all the shots where the killer punches through people's stomachs.
So I didn't do any research after watching the film. We're filming this episode a little earlier than we normally do, so we have a little bit less prep time. But I would say, yes, every single one-punch scene was definitely added in. And there is at least one, probably multiple scenes where characters' costumes change after a cut.
Yeah, it's totally possible those were filmed after the fact. But Bruno Mattei is someone to look into if you're interested in bad Italian cinema. So just last week, we mentioned the Emmanuel films. He did one called Emmanuel and the Erotic Nights. He did a movie called Libido Mania. He did Hell of the Living Dead, The Other Hell. He did a Caligula movie, Caligula and Messalina.
I think it's probably just safe to assume that every single Italian horror director has done one Caligula. It's probably like a rite of passage.
I mean, after his Caligula movie, he directed one called Nero in Poppea, an orgy of power. But American audiences probably know him best for Scalps, parts of Zombie 3. He directed an unofficial sequel to RoboCop called Robo War. He directed an unofficial cross between Terminator and Alien called Shocking Dark. That was actually released in Italy as Terminator 2. He directed an unofficial sequel to Jaws called Cruel Jaws. All these movies are hysterically funny if you enjoy this particular brand of bad movie. So Bruno Mattei, he's worth looking into. All right, so Leland, you've kind of already given us a hint, but before we get into the movie, what's your overall impression? Would you recommend this movie? Who do you think should seek it out?
This is one of those films that's more fun to riff than to watch. If you do not go in with that kind of mindset, I just feel like you'd have a hard time enjoying this film.
All right, yeah.
Look, I can only recommend this film to that special brand of cinemaphile who slipped in their kitchen, slammed their head on a countertop, and decided through post-concussion fog trauma that Troll 2 was like the 20th century's greatest contribution to cinema. If that is your demographic, this movie is right down your alley.
So, I definitely disagree with Leland. While I think this movie is really riff-worthy, and it is bad, don't get me wrong, it's badly made, but I think the story has some legitimately interesting things to offer. I think that it's immensely entertaining. I think there are good elements here, and as a later-day giallo, like, I think this is better than most of the giallos that came out in the late 80s, early 90s. Like, giallos have always been ridiculous, so I think you just have to embrace the ridiculousness. This movie is even more ridiculous because it was released in Italy as Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3.
Right. I mean, this is maybe the third giallo film I've ever seen, first being Troll 2. Second being Zombie 3.
Giallo is a genre, basically like Italian murder mysteries. And there are certain things that are characteristic of giallos. So killers, you don't know who they are until the end because they're either wearing a mask or you don't see their face. Oftentimes they're wearing black gloves. The movies are made such that everything is a red herring. Most characters are suspects at some point or another. And there's usually sort of garish exploitation of not just women, but everyone in the movie. So I would consider this a giallo, although it strays away from the overly, like, the plot here isn't as complex as it is in the case of some giallos. So yeah, I think this qualifies.
So giallo is a genre, not the director. What's the director's name?
Claudio Fragasso.
I meant to say this is the third Fragasso film I've seen.
Gotcha.
I don't think I have a tally of giallo.
Yeah, I think this is my favorite of his films that I've seen. But with that said, let's go ahead. I don't have a lot of trivia on this one. There's just not that much information out there. So let's go ahead and hear the trailer, and then we'll get into this very interesting plot.
Virginia Beach Police Department. Officer Gabrielle here.
I just got a phone call from a guy spying on me.
Was it an obscene phone call?
Yes.
Did he threaten you?
Yes.
The poor woman will never be the same again. She doesn't remember anybody or anything.
All of the victims were raped before they were tortured, mutilated, and killed by the masked maniac.
All right, there we go. So before we get into this, the first thing that pops out in the trailer is that this is supposed to be set in Virginia Beach. And I think it was actually filmed in Virginia. But do you know why all of these Italian films tried so hard to make it seem like they were set in America?
Is that really a common theme that most of them are set in America?
Oh, yeah. Pretty much all the Fulci films take place in New England. It's a pretty typical thing that they're supposed to be set in, like, Boston, New York, Virginia, somewhere, you know, on the East Coast.
I just imagine it's no different than how you have a lot of American cinema that takes place overseas. You know, for them, this is just an, you know, an exotic land ripe for, you know, entertainment.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. And then I also think they, from what I understand, they just thought that Americans wouldn't watch films that took place in other countries. And they really wanted to crack into the American market. That's why they made unofficial sequels to American movies. And that's why so many of their films are set in the United States. I think it's just a marketing thing.
I could see it.
Yeah, so this apparently takes place in Virginia Beach. And we open on, I guess it's a play rehearsal, but it seems like an aerobics video.
Yeah. So I... Well, first off, we should probably say, if you have not seen this film and y'all at home want to experience this train wreck for yourselves, as of this broadcast, Night Killer can be found in all of its ham-filled glory on YouTube in English with Italian subtitles. That's how I watched it. And at first, I thought, where are the fucking credits? Where's the lead-in? I watched this on YouTube, so my first thought was like, I guess the uploader cut the intro to avoid a copyright filter, but no, what a bold directorial decision with an abrupt start into the whitest possible dancing.
Yeah, but in an old-fashioned theater, right?
Yeah. I mean, what do you call this body flailing, right? Like,
So I have a theory.
Okay.
I developed a whole backstory about this scene.
Oh, please indulge.
So first of all, the director looks like Jodie Foster and she walks with a cane and she's really like overbearing and irritated. She's smoking. So I tried to think about what would lead this woman to direct what essentially looks like an aerobics video, but on a stage. And so this is what I thought. She used to be an aerobics dancer, right? But she injured herself. And that's why she walks with the cane. And this is her first attempt to get her life back and to try something new. And her parents always wanted her to do something respectable. But she chose dancing instead. And, you know, she's always seen herself as a disappointment. This is her attempt to move into a more respectable field of directing theater. And so she's blending the aerobics dance she knows and loves with what she thinks is the high class staging of a play.
Imagine paying a box office price to see a bunch of dudes perform the drowning chicken in front of a live studio audience.
Hey, I mean, in her defense, she's not happy with what she's seeing on stage either. She's just berating them about how bad it is.
Hey, that's not how you perform the Seizing Dutchman.
Right. So,
What is the theme here? Is Please Kill Me an aerobics theme?
I think so. As I said, like Bruno Mattei was hired to film additional scenes. And I think this was probably just an excuse to get more gore murders and to get some what he perceived as sexy dancing.
Oh, man. Do you think the original director didn't have the scene?
No, I don't think the original director had anything that came before the credits.
Wow. All right.
That's my theory. Okay. Because it doesn't have any bearing on the rest of the plot, right?
I mean, yeah, it's just a bunch of set pieces for mass murder, right?
Right. So one of the dancers shows up late and she goes to get dressed and she's being stalked by this Freddy Krueger lookalike. What did you think of this killer's look?
Well, first off, I was like, how can you chew out this dancer for being late? Like, how can you blame her? Why would anyone want to be on time to this movie? But, you know, I remember you telling me in advance that this film is more comparable to Nightmare on Elm Street than Texas Chainsaw. And I took this way too literally at first, because as soon as that ominous silhouette shows up, I was like, oh, I get it. The dance class is the nightmare. You know, not just for the character, but for us, the viewer at home, that have to see this. And spoiler alert, it ended up being real life and there's no escape. I wasn't sure if the audience was supposed to know if this was some kind of cosplay psychopath or a legitimate, like, cursed dreamscape horror man, right?
So, yeah, I wanted to talk about that because I actually really hate when there's masks like this in movies, because it's unclear whether it's a bad special effect or whether the character is supposed to be wearing a mask. Like in Halloween, no one thinks that mask is real, right? But in this movie, maybe they're trying to pass it as real and he just can't close his mouth. I just don't know, and it's frustrating.
Yeah, that's a great point. This movie kind of really made me appreciate like how tastefully picked other masks were in similar themed horror films like Scream, or like you were saying, Halloween.
Yeah, this mask looks like if you blended Freddy Krueger with the elf from Elves. If you've seen both of those films, you know exactly what I'm talking about. No ability to close mouth, like weird burn marks. It's a stupid looking mask.
This blonde got off so easy. Like, she only had to suffer like 3 minutes of filming and there's like an hour and a half left.
So one thing that I noticed, and this fits into my Bruno Mattei theory, he's wearing like a Freddy Krueger type glove, but the fingernails are like soft and flimsy whenever he touches anything, yet they can easily be punched through someone's chest cavity.
I mean, would you really trust that actor to carry around like an actual clawed weapon?
That's questionable. Yeah. But I also think that Fragasso probably started with that glove and it was supposed to look fake because it's a costume, right? He didn't intend for it to be punched through anyone. But Bruno Mattei was brought in and filmed these extra scenes. And so he was stuck with this flimsy glove and had to make it really violent somehow.
Well, they managed to do it.
Yeah. So needless to say, this dancer girl dies, and then he goes after the director who has gone upstairs for a moment. So they both end up dying in this scene. What did you think of the musical score in this part and in the rest of the movie?
I think the music is probably my favorite part of this film. I mean, I don't think it really matches in terms of the subject matter, but I guess it matches in like an Italian horror standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, this is very typical of Italian horror. This is the score is composed by Carlo Cordio, best known for his scores to Troll 2, Shocking Dark, 2020 Texas Gladiators, a bunch of other silly movies like that. But it kind of reminds me of like a 1970s TV melodrama score, but with synthesizers. And it's really repetitive, but I really like it.
There's like a sound, or there's a track in the middle of the movie that sounds like it could have been in like a Mega Man game from the PlayStation era.
Oh yeah, and there's moments where it kind of goes into like power metal or like really dramatic, right? We're gonna get there. But this is where we finally get the credit sequence, and then we meet this woman. And this is Melanie Beck, and she is letting her daughter go off with a man who we don't know yet. I didn't really know what they were going off to do. They just kind of drive off and walk around.
Yeah, he basically just takes her to a second mommy, and second mommy presumably takes the kid to school or something, somewhere away from this film.
Right. So we're going to find out who these people are, but not until the last like 20 minutes of the film. Right now, it's really unclear who they are. But on TV, we hear about a psychopath who is killing and raping people. And presumably, this is the guy from the beginning with the Freddy Krueger mask. Are you a fan of when the movie reveals information to us via TV newscasts?
These are some of the laziest expositions I've ever seen.
There definitely are some strange expositions in this film, but I like this. I like when we find out things via news coverage.
It's too blatant, though. Like, there's no subtlety at all. Do you think this was from the original director, or was this added in?
No, I think this is from the original director.
Oh, man.
And remember, he was trying to make a serious drama.
Oh, no, I got that impression about halfway through the movie.
Yeah, so anyway, I like this, but yeah, it's lazy. There is a lot of info dumping in this movie, and I'll point it out when we get there. But Melanie gets a call from someone who's drunk, and he takes pains to say that he tried to call, but it was busy, and she says, no, both of my lines have been free. So we find out that there are two phone lines. It's going to be really important to know. Did this seem like clumsy exposition to you?
A little. I didn't really pay too much attention to the fact that there are two lines.
I love that at a random point, she gets fed up with this conversation and she screams very hysterically, I don't have anything to say to you except don't call me anymore. What did you think of this woman's performance?
All of the acting in this movie is pretty ham, but I'd say she does the best job. She has the boar's head of ham in this film.
So her name is Tara Buckman, and she is also the mother in Silent Night, Deadly Night.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you should. There's like six of them, and they're all worth watching.
All six of them, huh?
Yeah, they are. I mean, after the third one, like none of them have anything to do with one another. But
so is this night really silent at this point?
Yeah,
they're fun. They're fun to watch. But I was going to ask you, because I just learned this. Do you know why Italian movies were all dubbed?
I assumed it was because they didn't have the I assume it was one of two things. Either one, they didn't have the level of audio sophistication to properly pick up the noise on all of these locations, these filming locations, or all of these actors like don't share like the same language, so they just dub everything afterwards after everyone just acts their scenes.
Okay, so that is true, that in many of these movies, the actors didn't speak the same language, but that's not why this started. So I just learned this last week. I know you don't watch Joe Bob Briggs, but he did an episode on the Lucio Fulci movie, House by the Cemetery, and he was talking with the director, Eli Roth, about it. And they pointed out that this dubbing thing originally started under Mussolini, and he wanted to make sure that the government had final say over whatever the audio was for a movie. And especially if a foreign movie was being released in Italy, they wanted to make sure they could remove any possibly subversive or anti-government dialogue in it. And so they made it a rule that films had to be entirely post-dubbed. But by the time like those laws were relaxed, people were so used to the dubbing that film studios just kept doing it.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I had no idea. I just learned that. As much as I love Italian horror movies, you'd think I would have known this, but no. So what I was getting at is, it's kind of hard to evaluate these performances because of the dubbing. So we get another kind of, this is one of the most interesting examples of exposition I've ever seen. Melanie stands in front of the mirror and massages her breasts very dramatically. And she says, "This is you. You have a daughter and a marriage that's on the rocks, and you only see gray skies ahead."
I haven't bothered to look up the screenwriter, but this scene right here just kind of screamed out to me that it was probably some boomer guy who wrote it. Like, what do women do to regain self-confidence? Yeah, I guess they just kind of feel themselves up in front of a mirror.
No, it's written by the director, Claudio Fragasso.
Oh, of course he wrote it. What a savant.
I mean, he also director. One thing that I think is interesting about this guy is all of his films I've seen show a remarkable lack of understanding for how people actually talk and behave.
Like, yes, it's almost as if an alien observed our civilization for maybe like 2 hours and then decided to write screenplays.
Right, exactly. And that's what, I mean, I think that makes these movies fascinating, but I think that's one of the reasons why Troll 2 is funny. And it's less prevalent in this one, but it's definitely still there. Like, this is an alien who does not know how humans behave. That's totally right. Melanie, during this breast scene, she gets a phone call, and this guy in this silly, like, Batman voice is telling her dirty things like, "I want to fuck you senseless." And we know he's watching her because he says, "Don't move, stay like that." And he says, "I won't kill you straight away because first I'm going to fuck your brains out." And so she calls the police. And this is where we find out that it was filmed that's supposed to take place in Virginia Beach, which I think is really interesting.
At some point in the movie, they actually got a Virginia Beach police cruiser in their shot. Like, they actually got permission from the PD to show off an official police cruiser.
Oh, I can totally imagine them not getting permission. I mean, this movie was not released in the United States officially until like a couple years ago.
I mean, most of the time you need permission from any kind of law enforcement or government agency before you use their logo or any property that belongs to them in your movie, right? But sometimes you can kind of skirt that. Locally for us, in Central Florida, there is a movie called Last Watch, I believe. This was a random movie I was watching on Netflix years ago. And you have the main character, who is a police officer, walking around her police station at night. It's a night shift. Oh, maybe it's called The Night Shift. And she's just minding her own business, walking around, doing the movie, when suddenly, bam, Sanford Police Department logo on the wall. They somehow got permission from City Hall to use the old Sanford Police Department to film as the setting for their movie.
Yeah, I've seen that one. I like it.
Okay, it is. It's called The Last Shift, 2014.
Yeah, I like that movie.
Like, why does this building look familiar on the outside? Bam, logo.
Yeah, so my suspicion is here that these were Italians who filmed this stuff without permission and never released the movie here, and so it just never became an issue.
Yeah, that's probably right.
But she does call the police, and then the killer calls back, and we see that he's calling from inside of the house because he's walking up behind her. She's already locked herself in because the police officer told her to. Is this a thing where, like, houses only lock from the inside?
Maybe in Italy.
Well, it's supposed to be in the Northeast, but I've never had a house like this. Maybe it's just before our time. I don't know.
I think really old houses had this. I mean, I don't know. When was the invention of the deadbolt? I'd say, as I look back at a deadbolt, as if it's going to tell me.
Yeah, I don't know, but this is something I only see in movies. She can't escape, and he's saying dirty things to her, like, I love your skin and your breasts and the way you smell. While this scene is totally ridiculous and nowhere near believable, I actually think it's pretty suspenseful.
Okay.
Yeah, you didn't feel any suspense here?
No.
All right. Well, maybe it builds with subsequent viewings. I don't know. But she gets a gun and she yells very dramatically, "Die, you bastard!" And she shoots him, but he survives. And the next line of dialogue is, she says, "You were dead." And he says, "I was pretending." So he takes off his mask. So we know that she sees who it is, but we don't see, which is a very typical giallo thing. We see that she's in the hospital after this, and we find out that while she survived, she remembers nothing. She's even forgotten her own name. We see a police officer talking to her doctor, and the cop wants to show her the mask to try to jar her memory. And the doctor says, and this sounds really professional, he says, "No, that won't work. If she can't remember faces, she won't remember a mask."
This doctor. I feel like it's like the director self-inserted himself as this character, because he's just as like alien and aloof as the screen, as this entire script. I like how as they're walking down the hallway, the police sergeant mentions, like, "Hey, we got an emergency plan for this woman." It's like, yeah, man, like, what are you gonna do, call J-Lo and hook her up to the mind machine from the cell? Like, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, and the cop says he wants to implement the plan, and the doctor says, "No, that's crazy." So this is our first hint that, like, there's something we don't know that's going to be transpiring in the plot.
As an aside, deadbolt locks have been around since before the 1900s. So, yeah, I guess there's not really an excuse not to have one.
Well, the excuse is that it adds to the suspense of this scene.
That also reminds me, this is the scene where, this is one of the scenes where when Melanie is confronted by the killer while she's at the front door, she, like, you know, listens to his whole nefarious speech and then runs to the phone to answer it. From the door to the phone, that cut, she completely changes her outfit. Like, her hair is different, she's missing a scarf, her clothes are different. And
I didn't notice that at all, but I become so engrossed in the movie, I tend not to notice mistakes like that. All right, so back to the hospital. We see Melanie's daughter, who disappeared with the stranger at the beginning, and she's with the man who she went off with and his wife, we're assuming. And this is so sad. She wants to go inside and see her mother, but the doctor is like, "You can come, but none of the adults can. You have to come by yourself."
This is like the world's worst doctor.
Yeah. I mean, he's entertaining to watch. I like this performance.
Yeah, I mean, good for us, but bad for his patients. All of them.
But anyway, so she goes in by herself, and Melanie doesn't recognize her because she remembers nothing. We get another news report that tells us Melanie is the fifth victim, and she's only one to survive. And the news reporter is interviewing the guy who, it's her neighbor. It ends up being her neighbor, who was watching her daughter. And he has a big scratch on his face. And he tells us that he interrupted the killer attacking Melanie, and the killer cut his face. And he says very proudly, "I'm the guy who saved her." But he didn't see the guy's face.
If it isn't apparent, the movie purposely doesn't show this scene for a very crucial reason.
Right. but let's keep that under wraps.
Is it under wraps?
Yeah, let's keep it a surprise.
All right.
So
I mean, it wasn't a surprise for me, but okay.
So we find out this movie gives us information in such weird ways. So the neighbor, whose name is Sherman, he tells the news reporter that Melanie's husband was a cop before he got booted off the force. And he says, if I were him, I'd kill that sucker, meaning the killer. But so this is how we find out that Melanie's husband was a cop and was booted off the force. And it is important to note that we have not seen Melanie's husband at this point.
I just want to point out that nowhere in history has there ever been a news broadcast or a reporter who has gotten this much information from someone walking out of a building.
Right.
Ever.
Right. But he also informs her that he is going, him and his wife are going to be taking care of Melanie's daughter, since Melanie doesn't remember anything and she's in the hospital. So we see Melanie escapes from the hospital and she's driving down the road in a convertible.
Is it an escape?
I think it's an escape because they say that they lost her.
I didn't get that impression. I got the impression they were just like, yeah, sure. You know, let her out.
Well, okay, so that might be the case because there's a twist, but at this point, we don't know whether they let her out or not. They do talk about having lost her. And so I assumed that we were supposed to think it was an escape.
This woman has amnesia, and they just let her get into an automobile and drive away.
Well, it's all part of the plan.
Yeah, the plan.
Because we're seeing the plan unfold here, although we don't know it. So as she's driving, we see a guy chasing her in a Jeep. Did you think this guy looked just like Matthew McConaughey?
No, not at all.
Oh, wow. I think he looks like Matthew McConaughey and he has like a similar voice. So I just referred to him in my head as Matthew McConaughey.
No, I think of the main protagonist as being like a great value Linda Hamilton, but no, I did not get that vibe.
The guy who I think looks like Matthew McConaughey, his name is Peter Hooton, and he's been in a bunch of Italian like exploitation movies. So Matthew McConaughey follows her to this building and they both go inside. You think this is a hotel?
Yeah, it's definitely a hotel, but like you're making it not, you're leaving out some of the subtext here. This guy is like being a total creeper. He's drunk driving and now stalking this woman throughout the city.
Right. I mean, I thought it was implied that he's following her and into a hotel. I mean, he's definitely being a creep.
But he's being very blatant about it. Like, he's not trying to be sneaky.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, he's yelling things to her from his car.
I mean, I guess in his defense, this is kind of like how you met people in the 90s before online dating.
I love this guy's facial expressions and reactions during this scene because Melanie gets him at gunpoint in the bathroom and she's like, what do you want? He's like, I just want to be friends. Right? And she says, you always try to make friends in the ladies' bathroom. And he says, it can happen. And his facial expressions are, as she tells him, she makes him strip off all his clothes and she threatens to shoot him and says that if she does, his career will be over. Is that like an insinuation that he's like, does porn or like, what is she insinuating?
That's what I thought he was trying to insinuate.
That's what I thought.
I don't know, man. Please don't shoot me in the career.
Right. It's a very odd line.
This whole scene is weird.
It is because she's like, throw your shirt in the toilet. And he's like, in the toilet? She's like, flush it. Flush it? Like, he's so shocked. But I love the performance.
Yeah, take off your pants. My pants?
Right. That's a better impression than I do. So, I'm just laughing because I'm reading ahead in my notes. But she leaves, and we get this shot of his clothes in the toilet, and the shot and the music and how long it lingers, it makes it seem really ominous for some reason. Like, I don't know. I don't know how to explain this scene, but it's strangely ominous.
I think this is probably the best scene in the movie. I mean, it actually promotes like a kind of a like female empowerment, right? Because she has her her offender like cornered at gunpoint, and she's making him do things.
Right. But he leaves and tries to follow her out, and of course he's naked because his clothes are on the toilet. And the guy at the front desk asks him what happened, and he says, "I got molested in the little boy's room."
Do you want me to quote that? Do you want me to pull it up?
Sure.
All right, hang on. Almost got it.
Hey, bud, what happened to your clothes?
I got molested in the little boy's room.
I want to come back to this scene later.
Okay. All right, just let me know when.
All right, let's keep going.
Yeah, so he's now he has more clothes in his car, and he gets dressed again, and he's chasing Melanie in the car, and we see Melanie on the beach, and she's laying out all these bottles of pills in the sand, this is where there's like a power metal type track in the background, very very dramatic and epic, and we get her in like profile shot downing pills on the beach.
Isn't it amazing that this is like the Virginia Beach and she is the only one out there?
Yeah, Virginia Beach is packed, or at least it is today. So this mystery guy, Matthew McConaughey, manages to track her down and stop her. And we hear that he knows who she is. He knows her name, but we're not supposed to know who this guy is yet. Did you have any idea who this was yet?
No, I did not figure out who this guy was until the reveal.
Okay, I didn't either when I first saw this, so I'm glad it wasn't just me who got it. I mean, I don't know that there is any... Okay, one thing I want to say about this movie is, as ridiculous as this plot is, if you watch it having seen it before and knowing the reveal, everything in the movie makes sense. Like, it all follows, not logically, because these people act like aliens, but if you know ahead of time, it's kind of like The Sixth Sense, where if you know the twist, all the puzzle pieces in the movie suddenly fit together.
You know, this would make a great double feature with Shutter Island.
Oh, I hate that movie.
Yeah, so do I.
So he says, "You've got to drink the seawater to throw up all that shit you've been taking." And she says, "Are you crazy?" So we switch to this girl in a bar, and she's talking to someone we don't see, who I guess we assume is the killer. And he like asks her to basically hook up with him. And she says this:
"I wasn't born yesterday. If a stranger asks for something, there's a rat hidden somewhere. It's what my mama always used to say. But seeing as I could never stand the sight of the old lady, I'll come out with you and risk the unknown." "To hell with the old bitch. Here's to the
other." Yes, so I like that exchange a lot. But she goes home with the guy, and it's like an art studio. Like, we see a bunch of paintings, which I don't quite understand where this is supposed to be, given that we later find out who this is and we know nothing about an art studio.
Maybe it's the director's studio and he wanted to show it off.
Maybe. She asks the guy, "What do you do in here?" And he says, I'm Santa Claus and I have a big present for you. Is that like a cultural reference that the director just did not understand?
No. Have you not caught on? This is a Christmas film.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I forgot. We should have saved this for Christmas.
'Tis the season.
So then he goes and puts on the Freddy Krueger mask and glove, and he comes back. And this scene is so weird. They like reenact Little Red Riding Hood, and she ends up saying, "What a big schlong you have."
Oh, grandma.
And then he drowns her in, like, is this paint water?
It's like Krispy Kreme donut glaze.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be paint water, like you would rinse your paintbrush out.
No, it's definitely donut glaze. And I like how I think they had to do like three takes and then they just kept all three of them. She seems mildly annoyed the first two times.
Well, I don't know why he bothers, because he ends up killing her by punching through her stomach like he's killed everyone else. But this could have been an added scene by Matei. I don't know. And then this is even weirder. After he's killed her, he puts a Freddy Krueger mask on her too. And he says, "Now we will make love, Little Red Riding Hood."
I mean, this is still the 90s, so it's okay to kink shame.
Are we kink shaming necrophilia or Red Riding Hood roleplay?
I mean, everything. Like, and the masks. Like, this, none of this is revisited, by the way.
No. But it's... since you brought that up, while this came out in 1990, it is obviously filmed in the 80s. Like, the sets, the hairstyles, the clothes. This is a very 80s movie.
I mean, like you've said in a prior episode, sometimes the Italian movie scene was just a couple decades behind.
Yeah. So this next scene, these scenes only get better to me. We go back to Melanie. The Matthew McConaughey guy has brought her home, and he dumps out all these pills and a gun on the bed. And he says, "All the things you need to kill yourself, but we're afraid to ask for." And she again asks, like, "What do you want from me?" He says, "I told you, I just want to be friends, and that it's a free country. You can kill yourself if you want." And he's brought fried chicken, like Kentucky Fried Chicken, for them to share.
And you know it's a hotel because they just eat it on the bed.
Well, he does. He's like, "You can kill yourself if you want to, but I'm going to enjoy this fried chicken." And he just starts eating it in her face.
Maybe this is like the Italian perspective on how like an American psycho would act.
This scene struck me as like a couple of drama students improvising, because as they talk back and forth, we're unsure whether she's going to kill herself, or he's going to kill her, because the gun like goes back and forth between the two of them.
There are a lot of long cuts in this hotel room between these two.
Yeah. And I love all of this dialogue. Basically, she chickens out of killing herself, and he says that he's going to kill her, but when he's ready. And in the meantime, he's going to be her master and she's going to do everything he says. And then he says, "I'm going to let off some steam," and he leaves.
And it's important to note that he is wearing the same black jacket as the killer.
Yeah, and we see the killer in the very next scene stalking a girl at an aquarium. So at this point, did you think that this guy was the killer?
I didn't want to believe it because of my initial gut reaction that we cannot discuss, but there was definitely some fuckery afoot. I just wasn't sure what the movie was aiming for with this whole second psycho scene.
I mean, it's obvious that they want us to think this guy is the killer, but I don't think they're doing a very good job of it. But that makes the movie stranger and more interesting to me, that this is a side plot about this guy kidnapping her and keeping her in a hotel room. And he kind of sometimes looks like the killer or behaves like the killer, but he's obviously not. It's a very weird dynamic. We don't see this, but we're told that it happens. Apparently, he tears this girl to pieces and feeds her to the fish. I liked this detail.
Like, all right, so you're a sex-craved lunatic cosplay psychopath, right? And you're cruising for women to you know, murder and debase. Where do you go? The aquarium after hours.
The aquarium, of course.
Aquarium after hours. Wow. Yeah, this news broadcast that followed the scene, the reporter specifically says, and she was like brutally murdered and raped before turned into fish food and fed to him. Like, yo, how do you know all that? Like, how'd you figure that part out? What did they even carry out in a stretcher if she was fed to the fish?
Maybe they had to carry out the largest of the fish.
I'm sorry, this large tuna is now evidence.
right. We see the kidnapper again, talking with Melanie, and his facial expressions are so wild and overexpressive, but I can't tell what emotions he's trying to show. It's just weird expressions. And they get into a fight about cussing. Like, he doesn't want her to cuss. It's so weird. See, I'm just engaged and fascinated by how strange these people behave.
It's like the bougie couple from Female Trouble, but without the irony.
All right, I can see that. But what I wanted to ask you is, like, I laughed a lot watching this, and I've seen it like 3 or 4 times, but every time I laugh more. But is this topic of like kidnapping a woman and holding her hostage and emotionally abusing her, like, is the topic so serious that we shouldn't be laughing at it, no matter how ridiculously acted and executed it is?
I mean, I think they could pretty much just do any sort of violent or like emotionally destructive act, and we're still gonna laugh at it because of the viewpoint of this film. Like, you can't take anything in it seriously.
Yeah, I don't know if it's ineptitude I'm sure it has to be a degree of ineptitude, but I also think it's just the director's lack of comprehension of how humans behave. I mean, and maybe partially a symptom of like people not speaking same languages and being dubbed and all that.
So at this point, you know, I still don't know this man's identity, and I'm trying to figure out if there is some kind of greater message here. Like, this is the point where I realized the director sincerely thought he was making a serious work about like the darker sides of humanity, and that like maybe the message here is like sometimes good women have bad thoughts and all they need is a good drunk driving perverted man to set them right. Like, I didn't know where they were going with this at all.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that is that they're throwing us curveballs intentionally. Like, in the next scene, we hear from the doctor that Melanie is probably suffering schizophrenia. And so that forces me to wonder, like, is she imagining the kidnapper? Maybe he doesn't really exist. And I thought, is there anything that we've seen between them that he would be required to exist for? And I don't think there is.
This is a film that I think would be torn asunder in a gender studies class, like a women's studies class, like rightfully so.
I mean, that's true of all giallo, really.
Yeah, but it would just be tied up between like the four horses and they'd all run in different directions. Like, this movie wouldn't stand a chance. But yeah, so the doctor comes on to another news broadcast and just barfs this psychological word soup that doesn't mean anything. So But yeah, the word schizophrenia popped up, and I started to wonder if this dude was real. Like, is this a high tension situation?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. But in this scene, we also find out that they saved her from swallowing a bottle of barbiturates. And that suggests that the police are like, that they're somehow connected to the kidnapper. Like, did you get that in this scene?
No, I totally missed that. I mean, I don't know if I was really a part of the major detective story at this point. And I was also starting to doubt any of the information that was being shown. I was not aware, though, you mentioned earlier that this genre is purposely full of red herrings. I wasn't really ready or familiar with that going into this film.
Yeah, that's the whole idea. And most of them are much more complicated than this. And rarely do they completely make sense by the end. But you just have to, like, you either love it or you don't. But the police chief does say that she may have been kidnapped by the killer. And he says the moment that she recognizes the killer, he'll kill her. And so this, I think, is supposed to add extra suspense to the scenes between Melanie and Matthew McConaughey.
I suppose. But there's a following scene at the police department between the doctor and the sergeant, detective, whoever, where the sergeant really gives the impression that he has no idea what's going on, like absolutely none. And this is a conversation that's only between these two. So is this a red herring or scuffed script writing?
I think it's just red herring.
Too much fish, man.
Yeah, I don't really know what's up with this scene. I also don't know what's going on with Melanie, because we see her putting on crazy makeup and she loads a gun. And when Matthew McConaughey gets back, she says, "I made myself up. I wanted to be beautiful for you." And was this
after shooting around into the mirror?
Yeah, this is she had just done that. She just shot into the mirror.
Right.
And he rushes into the room. And after she says this thing about wanting to be beautiful for him, he says, "Do you remember?" And she says, "I remember you're the one who's trying to kill me." And he says, "Anything else?" And then we don't know. At this point, we don't know what it is he thinks she might remember. But I'm guessing we're supposed to think that he is the killer and is afraid that she has remembered he's the killer.
Mm-hmm.
Because the news reports at this point, you know, one of the many, is reporting that she has been kidnapped by the serial killer. The landlord the guy who works at this hotel recognizes Melanie from the newspaper, and he calls the police on the Matthew McConaughey guy. A single cop shows up. The black cop that we've been following, and Matthew McConaughey very easily dispatches him by beating him over the head. And now him and Melanie seem to be on the same page. They're sneaking off together.
So did you want to specifically mention that this is a black cop? Because you kind of just like threw that out there. He's really the only cop.
Well, that's just how I recognized him.
I don't know. There's not really a point to bring up his skin color.
I just think it's a description.
All right.
Yeah, I think it's genuinely a respectful description to point out someone's race, assuming you know what it is.
Weren't you the guy who's trying to tell me that race should be abolished so that, you know, there's no distinction between races, so, you know, there can be no discrimination?
I mean, I think that in the very, very long term, deconstructing race is an ideal, but obviously race is a factor and people use race to describe themselves. So I don't think it's, in our current context, disrespectful to acknowledge race. I actually think it's vital.
Okay.
Yeah. I think if we don't recognize and talk about race, then I think we're ignoring the social discrimination and the systemic injustice that people face, and that we've got to identify race in order to deconstruct that. But the deconstruction of that, like the long-term goal, I think would be great to de-racialize people. Although I like the idea of a multicultural, multiracial society where people don't have to be beholden to a national identity.
Hey, if you're cool with it, I'm cool with it.
Cool. So did you understand why Melanie and her kidnapper suddenly seemed to be cooperating?
No, not at all. And your cat chimed in on that.
Meow. Yeah, there's no controlling her. So we see the guy with the scar on his face. He heard the news reports and he's taking a gun to hunt down the guy who kidnapped Melanie. Him and his wife have a fight.
Sherman, what are you doing?
Going out.
With a gun?
That crazy bastard who cut my face up. He's out there roaming around somewhere. Now he's got our friend Melanie and he's holding her hostage.
Why do you have to go? Isn't what he did to you already enough?
Annie, told you. I'm the only one who's seen his face. I'm the only one who can possibly identify him. Now, I did just like you said. I haven't told the police anything.
Okay. We'll tell the police. But leave the gun at home, Sherman.
No, someone's got to stop that crazy bastard.
So, did he say he didn't tell the police he saw the face?
Yeah, which is true. That's what he said. He told the police at the beginning, or he told the news person that he didn't see the face.
So, I mean, I think the only thing I really noted here for this scene was that everyone in the movie has been saying Melanie is the only person who has seen the killer's face. And then suddenly, bam, this guy is now saying he has seen the face.
Well, so this is what I think's going on. I think that as far as the wife knows, he did see the face, but she told him not to say anything because if they catch the guy, then they have to give the daughter back. And okay. So for her, this is all about keeping the daughter as her own.
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
Because the Scarface says to her, she's not worthy of our daughter, Clarissa. She's a tramp. She's been laid by everyone in 100-hour radius. And then the wife hugs the little girl and says, mommy's here. And the little girl says, you're not my mommy. And we see that this really upsets
yeah.
this lady.
Yeah, the stressed look right into the camera.
Right, exactly. Now things are getting even more confusing because we see Matthew McConaughey and he's at a payphone talking to the police. But we don't hear exactly what they say. We just know that the police say whatever he's asking for is unreasonable. Man. What did you think was going on at this point?
I just figured that he was trying to negotiate like a return for Melanie, or he was stringing him along.
I think you're right in this scene, but Melanie sees a newspaper headline that she's been kidnapped by the killer, and so she runs away. And the neighbor, the Scarface guy, picks her up on the street.
Man, and Virginia Beach is really a small city when, you know, you can just kind of drive 5 minutes around the block and see everybody you know.
Oh, I mean, it is. It's pretty small. Yeah, but Matthew McConaughey gives one of those overdramatic screams towards the sky, like the, no!
Oh, those. God. Yeah, you know, in hindsight, I wish I started a count for every time someone shouted no. It happens constantly.
Yeah, and they're all very dramatic. So the Scarface guy takes Melanie home to her house and says he's going to take care of everything to lock herself in. And that seems to jar her memory of the original scene where the police told her to lock herself in. So at this point, were you back to thinking that this guy was the killer?
I mean, I never like changed my mind on how the on who the killer was supposed to be. I just didn't quite understand what the second guy's role was in all this, or if he was even real to begin with.
Right. Yeah.
I guess he had to be real because he was interacting with, you know, with like the hotel manager.
Right. But there are points where it suggested maybe he's not. Anyway, if you have not figured it out by now, the Scarface guy is the killer. And that begins to become clear in this scene because they're at the house and she's beginning to relive the original scene where the same voice calls her and she, the guy with the mask comes in, but then he immediately takes the mask off and reveals himself. Why did he go put it on?
Why does this guy do, why does anyone do anything in this film?
Yeah, I don't know. But we get a flashback to the beginning scene, the things that she's forgotten because of her amnesia. And we see, yes, Scarface is the killer. And he says, my wife is right that you attract men like a bitch in heat. And he ties her up to the bed and makes her beg to die and gives her the knife and tells her to kill herself. But this is how she slashes his face and he gets the big scar.
This is a very prolonged scene where he's like, let me carefully explain to you in detail how you escaped. and it basically boils down into, yeah, I gave you the knife and then you cut me. Like, you didn't need to, you need an 8-minute scene for that.
Well, this movie's exposition throughout is nothing if not clumsy and unnecessary, but I very much enjoy it.
Why did she cut me, though? I gave her the knife to cut herself.
I know. He is very whiny. So he brings up Axel, and it says that you and Axel tried to set me up, but we don't know who Axel is at this point.
I immediately thought Axel was the other guy, but then I was like, wait, how do they know each other?
Yeah, no, same.
Set up.
Same. So he's about to kill her, and then suddenly she becomes like seductive, and she says, why did it take you so long? I've been waiting for you to come back to me. I miss the way you touch me and the way you feel. And they start making out, and obviously she's setting him up to like try to escape. So she stabs him and
with a switchblade.
Right.
And groin.
And he's going to shoot her, but Matthew McConaughey jumps through a window and shoots him.
He dives face first through this glass-paned door into a combat roll.
I know. He just jumps through it. Like, windows don't work that way. Especially, like, you could say, oh, it was old, but glass was only thicker then.
I mean, he's a big dude. He can probably throw himself through a glass door, but it wasn't just a glass door, actually. I think it was like segmented, like panes of glass.
Yeah, it was like a wooden door with a glass, you know, see-through window in the middle of it.
No, it's like, is it? I thought it was like 8 different like square, you know, like the multiple squares, like all framed out by wood, and he just leaps through all of it.
Yeah, maybe, but it regardless, yeah, he jumps right through glass face first. And we find out that he's Axel for sure because she calls him Axel. And then we get the whole explanation of this story. How else? But from the doctor on TV.
Yo, those reporters didn't even wait for them to show up and go inside the house. They showed up before the police did. How?
They heard the breaking glass.
I guess so.
Or they were just staking out this house because they're waiting to see if Mrs. Beck returned. Anyway, we find out that the police and the doctor thought that if Melanie relived her experience, it would jar her memory and she would remember who the killer was. Axel, the kidnapper, is her husband, but he was suspended from the force. And now that he's gone through this whole charade of helping her relive the trauma, they say that he's back on and he's going to get a promotion. And we see the whole family together and happy. What did you think of this reveal?
Yeah, I did not expect that at all. I was completely floored.
But was it a satisfying reveal, or were you disappointed? Did you have that level of investment?
Being disappointed implies that I had some kind of expectation. And any expectations I had for this film were gone within like 3 minutes.
As we see the family together and happy, we hear the same ominous music over top of it, as if something is wrong. But this should be like a happy scene. It doesn't seem like anything's wrong. It's really weird. It's really jarring.
You know, he was supposed to be in character like the whole film. Axel was supposed to be in character the whole film.
Right.
But he is still acting like sus as fuck in this bedroom scene with the wife.
Yeah, what I wrote in my notes is that this guy does... Either he's doing a great job playing a sleazy kidnapper, or that's just him. But then I can't accept him as like a loving husband. He still seems like the sleazy kidnapper.
Right. And this is what I want to go back to, that hotel scene near the beginning of the film, where he inexplicably just turns around and tells the hotel employee at the front desk, you know, that he got molested in the little boy's room. Like, was that in character?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. But as they're having this scene that's supposed to be loving with this sleazy kidnapper guy and the ominous music, the little girl goes and gets a present from under the Christmas tree.
And that was initially given to the family by the killer.
Right. And so we see that inside must be a mask, like the killer's mask, because she wears it and she walks into her mom's bedroom, and in the killer's voice she says, "Do you recognize me, Mrs. Beck? I'm back." What did you think of this ending?
Wow, you know, so deep. The original evil was the mask all along.
When did Halloween 4 come out? Because this is the exact same ending as Halloween 4.
I am familiar with Halloween 4's legacy, and that is exactly why I haven't seen it yet.
I think it's one of the better ones. All right, so it came out in 1988, so maybe this is ripping off Halloween 4. I don't know, but Halloween 4 ends with pretty much the same exact scene where the little girl who's the protagonist throughout the movie shows up in the evil clown mask from the first Halloween and seems like she's going to stab Jamie Lee Curtis. Or not Jamie Lee Curtis, but she's going to stab the woman who is playing the Jamie Lee Curtis role. So I don't know. Maybe this is ripped off of that. It's very similar.
Second guessing which scenes in this movie were by the original director and which ones were added after the fact.
You think this final scene was added?
It certainly could be. I mean, the fact that the killer is in a mask is really convenient for adding scenes, right? Because you don't need the original actor. You can just throw them in anywhere.
No, and I don't know if the same actor played it throughout or not, but
like we see him just from the back. So for all those bar scenes where he's using the Batman voice into the phone,
right?
You know, that could have been anybody.
I am not a huge fan of this ending scene. I think there's probably a better way that, like, I would have been fine with her just opening up the box and the mask was there. But her saying in the silly voice, "I'm back, Mrs. Beck," that's a little far for me.
Is it normal for Italian horror films to always end on like a bad or ominous note?
Mm.
Can you think of any good endings off the top of your head?
I mean, a lot of giallos just end with like the killer being caught and then the main characters are fine. So I wouldn't say this is typical. I'd say this is more of a ripoff of what happens in American slasher movies, where they always have to show you some hint that there might be a sequel.
Well, how unfortunate that we did not get a Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4.
One thing that I read in Claudio Fergasso's IMDb bio is that today he still discovers young actors and he supervises young directors in their films and never stops because cinema is his life. Can you imagine this director mentoring up and coming directors?
No, not at all.
So you think that's a bad idea?
It could be worse. There have been worse ideas, but it's all about connections, right? You just got to take every opportunity you can get. And if this man were to approach me, an emerging, budding film creator, I probably would just, I would probably take advantage of the opportunity just for the social connection.
I mean, I think that working with this guy would be an experience.
Lots of things can be described as an experience.
I suppose so, yeah. So IMDb says that his trademark is downbeat endings where the main protagonist meets a terrible fate.
Oh, maybe it is just the director's thing then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so why don't you give your final thoughts and a star rating out of 4?
Gosh, right? In my immediate recollection, this is probably the worst Christmas movie I've ever seen. I mean, maybe I'll find a worse one if I were to watch the Lifetime channel at the end of the year.
I have some ideas that we might do for Christmas.
Oh, great. I mean, outside of Elves, right?
Oh, Elves is fantastic.
It is.
I know what you're saying.
All right, so maybe I'm just the no fun fuddy-duddy, but this film wasn't really my vibe. I mean, I enjoyed riffing Night Killer, but that alone doesn't make the film worth watching if you haven't seen it already. Hey, fun fact, not a single kill in this film was performed at night.
That is interesting. I've never noticed that.
Yeah, this film title comes from how my free time, my night, was absolutely culled and wasted. 1.5 stars.
All right. Well, I really like this movie. As I said at the beginning, okay, so this is a hard one to rate because it's certainly not good, right? Like, the acting is bad. There's all kinds of illogical character developments. The behavior and dialogue suggests that it was written by an alien. It's got the same sort of bizarre behavior that you see in all of Fergasso's movies. And if you've seen Troll 2, then like this isn't quite as bizarre as the behavior in that movie, but it's strange. So all of those things being said, it's immensely entertaining to me. And it combines lots of things about Italian cinema that I like on their own. Kind of cool death scenes, overacting and weird dubbing, cool progressive synth music, weird American locations for an obviously European film. Like, these various aspects of Italian horror films, and in particular giallos, are just sort of precious to me. And maybe it's because I have just seen a lot of better giallos. I don't know. But if I were to rate this film on like quality, maybe like a 2. But if I'm rating it in terms of entertainment value and my enjoyment, And I genuinely think that there's interesting things going on in this plot. Like, we didn't really talk about the realism of using traumatic experiences to jar memory. And I think that it's portrayed in a ridiculous, unrealistic way in this movie. But they are touching on some, like, nonsense pop psychology that I like seeing in my movies. By entertainment value, I give this like 3.5 stars.
Yeah, it definitely feels like the director skimmed through a AP psychology textbook and decided, you know what, that's enough to make a movie right there.
Well,
went straight to the glossary and just picked out some words.
If you go, listeners, if you go and watch this movie and you haven't seen it before, just go in thinking, this is this guy's vision of what a serious psychodrama film looks like. And that will give you, I think, every indication that you need to understand this guy's view of the world, of reality, of human behavior. This movie might tell us something psychologically about the directors, even if it gets all the character psychology wrong.
I think you can say that about any film, though. Whether, like, they pour their heart into it, you know, how, like, their worldview, like that, you can say that of any film. So I mean, it's definitely more obvious in this one. There is soul put into this film. It's just a very janky soul.
All right, well, I think that's the perfect note to end on. There is soul, but janky soul. Night Killer, 1990. All right, 1.5 stars from Leland. I'll go in the middle and say 3 stars from me. I definitely think you should seek this one out.
That's not even middle. That's upper middle.
I round up. I'm generous. So next week, we are going to be doing another Italian movie. This one's really obscure, but Leland tells me it's available on YouTube. It is called Bermuda, Cave of the Sharks. And I suspect that most of our listeners have never seen this before. So I suggest you check it out before next week. This is kind of an adventure movie, but it's got beautiful underwater footage. For those of you who are music lovers, it's got gorgeous underwater, like, library music vibes by the score is done by Cipriani, who was a French Italian film composer he did the score for Tentacles, as well as a bunch of, like, premiere, actually great movies. There are scenes in this movie that are beyond description that I'm going to have to think about how to describe to you, because this is a weird one. So check it out and then join us next week. And in the meantime, you can find everything that we do. Reach out to us at video.store.nightmares on Instagram. Wherever you listen to us, please rate, review, and subscribe. That'll help get our publicity up. And for all of you who are VHS collectors out there, I'm coming up with a giveaway that we're going to do in the next few weeks just to celebrate getting this off the ground. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be exciting. Do you have any last words, Leland?
Thank you for your continued support.
All right. And join us next week. We'll see you then to discuss Bermuda, Cave of the Sharks. See you later, everybody. Bye.